WGN Plus, where Chicago rocks. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode posted at WGNplus.com. And don't forget the landing page. Go to the entertainment section. You'll see Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Click on there. And you'll be able to access 94 previous podcasts. Yes, 94. Which can only mean that this is episode 95. As we're counting them down to the big 100. Ponderous, man, ponderous. 95. Wow. Yeah, I think the first one was in mid-May of 2016. So we're actually approaching not only the 100th episode, but we are also approaching the two-year mark of the podcast. So if you've been listening since May of 2016, we certainly thank you for your loyalty, stopping by every week to hear what's on my mind. But at the same time, if you've only recently discovered the podcast, first of all, A, what's taken you so damn long? And secondly, you can catch up by going to that landing page. Because I've said many times, I often refer back to topics and other podcasts of the past when there's something new or interesting to update things on. So this way it keeps you in the loop as we continue to do our ongoing dialogue here via the podcast. I've said the loop just now, and that was not by accident. Here in the Chicago area over the last couple of weeks, we had the interesting news that one of the more iconic stations in Chicago radio was sold. And not only was it sold, but its longtime rock and roll format is now changed, as the new company is a religious-based company and is broadcasting a whole different format of inspirational and religious types of programming. And so Chicago radio has lost yet another legendary station. And for people of a certain age, it's been in this station, in this city for a while, the Loop, WLUP 97.9, at one time, its tagline or its slogan was "Where Chicago Rocks," and it really was an influential station here for many reasons. It certainly helped make the career of a host of radio personalities who continue to this day to broadcast in the Chicago area, and many who have gone on to become broadcasting Hall of Famers, like most notably Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer, whom I worked with for many years. And there are some great personalities, Kevin Matthews, and obviously Jonathan Brandmeier, who spearheaded a great renaissance for the station in the 80s and early 90s. And it was kind of Steve and Gary that started it in the 70s, in the late 70s, up through the mid-80s, and then Brandmeier came into town and really took the station to another level as well. And it's always been a mainstay in terms of rock and roll. It was a very important station in the late 70s when rock and roll was just beginning. There was no such thing as classic rock as we know today, because it was being made. It wasn't classic yet. I mean, there was some rock and roll, obviously, that was from the 60s, but even at that time, by the late 70s, 1977 is when WLUP became a music station. At that time, it was called more of an album-oriented progressive rock FM station. And by that, it meant that they weren't playing the top 40 hits that in Chicago at that time were being played by WLS and WCFL and WMET. Those were kind of the big main top 40 stations. Now, the biggest top 40 station probably is still WBBM-FM, but there are some others. But at that time, WLS and WCFL on the AM and WMET on the FM and then The Loop. And but as they started, it was kind of a really kind of an FM hipster station at the time, playing, like I said, progressive radio, album-oriented. So you'd hear, well-known songs, but they'd also dig deeper into the albums and play album cuts or deep tracks, or sometimes they'd play a whole side of an album. It was really an interesting time. Radio is so different now, commercial radio, so different as to the way it is presented. But there was a time when radio was really, music radio was actually interested in the music and interested in informing their listeners and turning their listeners on to new music or music they never heard of. There was really a whole different kind of a relationship between the listener and the radio station. And that's why some of the radio personalities that have been in this city for so long have, because back then, 35 or 40 years ago, there was a personal connection that the listener created with the host, much more than there is today, which is a shame. And I certainly was one of those listeners who was driven to the radio because of not only my own interest in music, but then the personalities themselves. And a mix of sort of the cool DJs who knew a lot about music, and you can tell their passion for the music. And they would play different kind of songs. The DJs had a lot of freedom to choose their own music on an FM station, as opposed to the AM top 40 hits, which played the same songs almost every hour or every 90 minutes. What was cool about The Loop was that there was certainly a playlist, but there was also some flexibility. And so the DJ could play some songs that they just liked or artists that they liked, and they helped introduce the audience to, as I said, not only new music that was coming on that they had access to, but also, hey, did you ever hear this fourth song on, you know, this album? Because here it is. And that was a neat freedom. And I know for me, as a young kid, listening to the radio and getting into music, The Loop was very influential in my musical knowledge. I'm a huge, you know, music fan of all genres. Obviously, rock and roll is my preferred musical form. But I've really become a huge music fan. As I've said many times, I've got my iPod's got 24,000 songs on it. And if you go to my Facebook page, for the last almost 3 years now, on a daily basis, this is how much I love music. I have a little feature on my Facebook page every day. I call it Elton Jim's Jam-Packed iPod. And I feature a song that is on my iPod. And it's not just very well-known songs. In fact, the object of the whole feature is to just as I was saying, what the DJs from the past used to do was kind of turn people on to some music that they may have never heard before, or they may have forgotten. And the idea came for me one day. I was in my yard, and I just had my iPod on. I just had, you know, the mix on to just let it, shuffle around. And all these songs that I hadn't heard from were just playing indiscriminately. And I hadn't heard in such a long time. And I was like, oh, my God, I forgot about this one. Oh, my God, I used to love this song. And I said, wouldn't it be cool to share some of those? And so that's where that idea came from. And it's fun for me to do. And it's really nice that a lot of people click on a daily basis. And they either say, oh my gosh, I had forgotten about this one, or wow, I never heard this one before. And so it's kind of fun, and I've been doing that for 3 years. So I've always been interested in music, and when I was still in college, I started writing about music. I had a regular music column for a local newspaper group out in the western suburbs, the Elmhurst Press and the Press Publications, newspaper group. And I did that for, wow, let's see, I was... I would say for at least 7 or 8 years, and then I wrote for the music reviews and feature stories for the Illinois Entertainer for more than 10 years, and I also had a film column for about 7 years with the Illinois Entertainer, and then I continued my writing, and I've always written about music for I've had pieces in the Chicago Tribune and in magazines nationally as well as locally. Most recently, last summer, I wrote a couple of music pieces for the magazine that is given away at Ravinia during their season. I did a story about Diana Krall, the jazz musician, and also Frankie Valli of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, and obviously Jersey Boys. So I've always been interested in music, and I have to say that WLUP, The Loop, here in Chicago, was majorly influential in me getting into music. If you ever saw the film Almost Famous, which was written and directed by Cameron Crowe, who was a 16-year-old writer for Rolling Stone. Talk about a blessed life. He was there right at the beginning in the early 70s when rock and roll was beginning to take hold and become a cultural kind of entity, and here he was a 16-year-old kid, and so he was able to interview some of the legends of rock and roll when they were just beginning. And if you love rock and roll music, you want to see the movie Almost Famous. Came out, I believe, in 2001. And there's a great scene, and it's autobiographical, about Cameron Crowe's life. It's about a 16-year-old kid who loves rock and roll and submits a couple of stories to a magazine and suddenly finds himself being a writer. And his mom, played by Frances McDormand, who just won the Academy Award, driving him to the concerts because he's 16 years old and he can't go on his own. But all of a sudden he's backstage with backstage passes and he's hanging out with all these rock stars and he's 16 years old. It's kind of a fantasy, but it was really true. And one of the great scenes about it, though, that really resonated with me was that he had an older sister, and she was about 18 or 19, and she was leaving home. I don't know where she was going, whether I can't remember if she was going to college or going off somewhere with a boyfriend or something, but she was leaving, and she pulled out all her vinyl albums, and she gave them to her brother, who at the time was 16 years old, and she said, "Here, these are the albums that you need to listen to and learn. This is your core." And so many people learn about music from their siblings, from their older siblings. But I was an only child, so I didn't have a sibling to learn from. So I had to sort of pick this up on my own. My mom and dad were a little older, and they weren't into rock and roll. So I wasn't going to learn about, Elvis Presley or Chuck Berry or Little Richard or Jerry Lee Lewis. Or even, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles or the Who or anybody like that at that time from my mom and dad. I did learn a little from an older cousin of mine, my cousin Louise, who used to love, she bought every 45 there was. I hope she didn't throw those away because she had some amazing 45 singles that she would go out and buy every week. And that's why I learned a lot from about music, too. She liked Motown. And so that's actually my first real exposure to music was probably not even more. I mean, it was top 40 radio, but I really, because my cousin Louise listened to Motown and R&B, I actually remember a lot more and learned and knew more Motown and R&B songs when I was a little kid than I did like the top 40, because that's what she used to buy all the time. But as I said, I didn't really have that daily kind of exposure to that from a sibling. And so I had to find different avenues. And so for me, the radio was where I really got my musical education initially, and then it sparked enough of an interest in me that I began to explore on my own. But there's no doubt that in 1978 and 1979, when the loop began to get prominent, I learned a lot from the DJs, as I said, who had some freedom to play the songs that they wanted, as well as the popular songs of the day. And in fact, so much so that that's why I'm talking about the loop here, because I actually have, it's been an interesting connection that I've had with it. So when I was 17 years old, you know, as I said, I was way into music. And I was listening to the radio every day, and I had in my mind that it might be kind of cool to, boy, there's these guys in the radio, what a great job, and what a fun job. And at the time, as I said, I was a huge fan then of Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer, who then went to great fame and prominence, not only here in Chicago, but nationally when they staged the disco demolition event at Sox Park in July of 1979. And so then I said, "Wow! I could even be. Not only can you be into music, but you could have fun doing it at the same time. What a great job!" But when I was 17, on the loop, they had a contest at the time. This was in the early '80s, called the Chicago Star. And the whole idea was that for an hour on a Sunday, they let the audience host their own show. And you got to pick your own music, and you did an hour shift. It was your show, Chicago Star. And so you had to write in a letter and explain why you thought that that you should be chosen to host your own show. And so I was 17 years old, which was kind of young. Most of the people listening at that time were a little older, at least that were in this contest, because I used to listen to it all the time, every Sunday. But I had this feeling that I've always enjoyed talking to people. I always got in trouble in school. I always got very good grades in school, but I also got in behavior, you know, like on your report card. Remember on your report card where you got your grades, but then underneath it, it always had like little behavioral things that you can get in trouble for. Mine was always talks too much. So it's no surprise I'm here. Jim's a pleasure to have in class, and he's always very, he always participates and blah, 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 but he tends to talk too much. So, wow, surprised that I'm here right now, right? But, so anyway, I sent in this letter to the Loop, 17 years old, and I explained why I wanted to be, host my own show as part of the Chicago Star contest. And I played baseball in high school. And I'll never forget this. I came home one day from one of our games, and my mom says, "You got a phone call from a loop?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "I don't know, some loop called. And they said they want you to go down to the station on Saturday to record some radio show. What did you do?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding?" And my mom says, "No." And I said, "What?" I said, "Well, you know, I entered this contest. There's this contest that you could host your own show for an hour." And so I had to do it. And I was a starting catcher on the baseball team, and I told my coach, I'm like, "Look, I got to go do this. I'm sorry I have to miss this game, but I've got to go do this. This is too cool." And so my mom took me downtown. We went to the Hancock Building, which isn't going to be called the Hancock Building anymore, sadly. But we went down. I think it was the 37th floor where the old Loop Studios used to be. And I went up there, and I was like in Mecca. It was like I felt like I was in heaven and at home at the same time. It was so cool and so just, you know, startling as a, you know, 17-year-old kid to, you know, all you saw from the radio was your radio, and you just heard this stuff. And I walk in, and then you go through the hallways, and there's the studios, and there's the mics, and there's the board, which I'm looking at right in front of me right now with all the little lights and all the little meters going up and down in the studios and the microphones and the producers' rooms. And oh my gosh, it was like a Disneyland to me. It was such a foreign place, but it looked so cool and so exciting. And they brought me into this room and they said, "Well, here, you know, you're going to do your hour show, so pick your song." So I got to pick out, I for an hour show with commercials, I mean, who knows, there's probably maybe 10 songs at that, maybe 12, I don't even remember now. I've still got the cassette tape. I need to somehow digitize that so I don't lose it, but I hope it still plays. I can't find a cassette player, that's my biggest problem, but I still have the tape. And I just remember I went in and some of the songs I chose of the day, don't forget, this is like 1981. I remember these were all new songs at the time. Like, you know, Phil Collins in the Air Tonight, or I think Talking Heads did Take Me to the River. There was a great song by Michael Stanley Band called He Can't Love You. And I can't remember some of the other ones. I think I had to have thrown a Bruce Springsteen song in there. I was huge into Bruce at that time because The River had just come out. And I don't know if I had an Elton song, which is interesting because at that time, Elton wasn't that popular. So wouldn't that be fun? I have to go back and listen to that tape. But anyway, I went in there and recorded that show. And I just had a ball, and my mom was in the other room watching me, and I was talking up the songs and talking about the songs themselves or the artists, and it felt so natural to me, even though I was 17 and I had never done this before at all. But I had listened to these DJs for the last 3 or 4 years as I was a little kid growing up, and so I knew what they did and I knew how they did it, and it just seemed so natural and easy to me. And the coolest thing was when I was done recording it, it aired then actually on Easter Sunday of 1981. Never forget that because we were at my relative's house and we all listened to it while it was on live and I was recording it. But the coolest thing was I got done. I had such a good time. And it just felt, as I said before, so natural for me. And the engineer who had worked at the station, who was recording this for me, when we got done, he's like, "I did an intro to a song." So while the music was playing, I talked over the music, and then they call it hitting the post, where then you stop talking and then the vocal starts. And there's kind of an art to it because you have to know the music. And I know these songs backwards and forwards because I just love music and I always, you know, memorize the songs and everything. And so here I was at 17 in this whole weird little world, but I hit the post. And the engineer goes, "Wow, that was pretty good. You should do this for a living." And he may have thought that was just a little joke and a funny little thing to have said, but that, boy, did that ring true in my ear. And I always had a sense that this might be kind of a cool thing, but when I was sitting in that chair behind that microphone and playing that music and talking and just being so excited by this, I felt very natural. And when he said that to me, it really stuck with me. And, you know, 40 years later, here we are. So that was on the loop. And then, as fates would have it, I pursued a radio career, but I was also in other media trying to get a way to get into radio here in Chicago because it's not easy. At least it wasn't at that time. Believe me, these days it still isn't. But I did actually host a weekend show for about a year and a half on AM 1000, which was the Loop AM 1000. So it was that kind of their sister station, which now it's now ESPN AM 1000, but it used to be the Loop AM 1000. And so I did that for about a year, and then sadly they sold the station to ABC, which is ESPN. But I did that for a year, and that came about because I started to work and do like a little segment on Gary Meyer's solo show in the early 90s. And then after Gary left, then I worked with Kevin Matthews for about 4 or 5 years on his show on The Loop. So here was this station that I listened to as a young kid that influenced me, that I was actually on as a teenager. And then years later, I was on it myself. And then if you know anything about me, obviously from here at WGN. Years later, I worked with Gary as his sidekick for almost 7 years, and a great chunk of that was right here at WGN. And because Steve and Gary were so influential to me from the Loop, their Loop days especially, when Gary and I first worked together, we were at WCKG, which is now a CBS station, or always was, but was 105.9. And Gary and I were in the morning from 8 to 11, and Steve Dahl was on in the afternoon in his own show from, you know, 3 to 7. And about three or four times in the year that we were there, before that station's format got switched and we were let go, Steve and Gary, for the first time in, at that time, say 20 years, did about two or three shows together where they guested on each other's show. And Gary went on Steve's show a couple of times, and one time Steve came on Gary's show. And so I was in the studio, and it was like I was sitting with, you know, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig in Yankee Stadium. You know, I mean, these were two guys that were my radio idols, and as I said, influential in me wanting to do this. And suddenly I found myself in a studio with just the three of us. And I just remember saying, well, you know, I'm going to just sit back here. I'm not going to take too much of the time, because the fans want to hear Steve and Gary, and so do I, because I was a fan as well as anyone else. And so I said, I'm just going to sit back and just let them do it. But I think they were nervous because they hadn't really done radio together for a while. And so I was sitting there, and Steve actually made a comment about me and to me to sort of get the conversation going. And so then I said, well, hey, if he's going to open the door. And so here the three of us were going back and forth, and we were laughing and having a good time. And that was one of my favorite days in radio. And it was, as I said, really talk about a childhood dream come true. I just love the radio. I love being on the radio. And so it was a sad day to hear about the Loop, even though, you know, the Loop hasn't had the impact that it used to have back in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. But it is very sad to see a station like that had such an iconic standing and did play such an influential role in Chicago radio and in music. The Loop used to play a lot of local bands in the late 70s and early 80s, which were not getting airplay around the country, and they helped to break them, like Off-Broadway, which was a huge band here in Chicago and actually wound up getting some national attention with their first album, at least, On, with the song Stay in Time. And there was another group called The Hounds that got a lot of play, and The Shoes. I remember those were two or three bands. There were a lot of others that the Loop would be playing local music. So the connection to the city and to the listener, it was a very unique station. And as I said, then when Steve and Gary became prominent, it became kind of a fun little clubhouse for listeners to come to every day, and became more music and talk. And so it's sad to see it go, but I'll tell you, I'm not surprised, because radio has been changing greatly in the last 10 or 15 years with the advent of the internet, and certainly with the iPhone and the smartphone, and now podcasting and all the other options that people have. We were a much more communal world in so many ways, in entertainment, in music, in movies. And we'll talk a little later about that with Emily in the Pop Culture Club segment about the Oscars. And so there used to be so many shared experiences that now there's a great freedom that we have, that the internet and the smartphone has allowed us, and all these different platforms has allowed us to have this freedom to watch whatever we want and to listen whenever we want, whatever, whenever, wherever. So that's an amazing access and amazing freedom that we have that we just did not have 30 or 40 years ago. But what we also lose with that freedom is the communal sense. And so it used to be where the new song or the new album or the new movie was something that you shared at the same time with your group of friends or your wider group of social people with school, you know, your classmates or, you know, things like that. And you all were hearing it and experiencing it at the same time. And that gave you a connection not only to the music or the movies, but it also gave you connection to those people. You remembered where you were when you first heard this album, or you remember going to your friend's house and listening to a new album that just came out, or listening to the radio with them. That's what I used to do with my friends. My friends Tom and Jack, we would listen to Steve and Gary all the time together. And you just don't have that anymore, which is a shame, because it really creates not only a bond of a friendship, but it adds another wrinkle to the actual music. You remember those songs not only for those songs and their own intrinsic value, but then you also remember about the memories that you tie to them. And many times they're life memories too. And I'm all about, you know, everybody, a lot of people say, oh, nostalgia, ugh, nostalgia. I'm very nostalgic, and I am unapologetic for it, because that's why we collect memories. That's why we make experiences, so we can look back on those and remember them. You shouldn't stay stuck in the past. I mean, for me, what I love about looking back is that if I want more memories, that means I have to be in the present or in the future, so I can make more memories so that 10 years from then, I'll have new ones to think about. So, nothing wrong with nostalgia, at least as I'm concerned. It actually makes you want to be more present and more forward-looking so you can create more memories and more experiences that then one day you can look back on and smile and hold close to you. So, but what's sad about the loop, it's not surprising, as I said, because I don't think any of us who have grown up in the rock and roll era ever would have thought this would have happened, but it's very obvious, and a lot of people maybe don't want to admit it or don't want to point it out, but I certainly have no problem doing it, because it's just fact, and it's just reality. Rock and roll is not the dominant musical force that it used to be, and it hasn't been for a while. And all you have to do is obviously look at the music charts and see what's popular, and or just as a quick kind of survey, watch the Grammy Awards, and you'll see. I mean, especially this year, the Grammys were dominated by hip hop, and rap, and right now the most popular radio station in the city in terms of music is a station that just started a few months ago that plays classic rap. So now there's already a genre of classic rap music. And so that's a whole thing that has certainly developed and is now the dominant force. And those of us, like I said, who grew up on rock and roll and it was such an important thing for so many decades, never would have thought that rock and roll would maybe go the way of jazz or big band, of at times the dominant music of the time. But as time went on and decades went by, becomes more of a niche, more of just a music of the past. And I hate to say it, and I know there's a lot of rock bands out there, and I'm not putting you down, but it's clear that in terms of the public and the mass tastes, that rock and roll at this point is still around and still has its power, and there's still some of its icons still around. You know, Paul McCartney and, you know, Ringo Starr, the surviving Beatles, and the Rolling Stones are still around, and the surviving members of The Who are still around, and, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Elton John and Billy Joel and people like that, Paul Simon, you know, Bob Dylan. So many icons still around. And they are the ones who are still filling up arenas and stadiums. But, you know, it takes 4 days and hundreds of bands at Lollapalooza to attract what the Rolling Stones attract in 4 shows. So that tells you something about the unique draw that rock and roll had and how it is gone now. And I hope that there's some savior of rock and roll. But I really, and I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer here, but I'm just being realistic. And I wouldn't be surprised in the next 10 or 15 years when so many of these icons that I just said and many others, just through reality, folks, those people are either going to pass away or certainly retire. And when those big names who are still out there and still drawing people go away one way or the other, I wonder if rock and roll is going to really be a very small niche kind of musical genre that has its diehard fans, of which I will be one, no doubt about it. But will it be like jazz? Oh, you're into rock and roll? Oh, interesting. Cool, man. Oh, you're into big band music? Oh, interesting. But don't forget, in the 30s and 40s, that was the dominant music. And in the 50s, say 40s and 50s and early 60s, jazz was huge. Or folk music was huge in the late 60s. And now those are all fringes. And we never would have thought rock and roll seemed so revolutionary and so world-changing culturally that you thought it would always be in the fabric. But hip-hop and rap and even country now, are, I would say, are the two major types of musical forms that are dominant and will be for the next several decades. And the funny thing is that back in the 70s, like I said, there was the disco demolition. You know, there was this big fight. I don't know how serious it was, but for some it was. You know, disco versus rock, because disco became a huge fad. Not only music-wise, but culturally, Saturday Night Fever. Everybody was wearing the outfits and going to the discos and dancing, and it was a part of the. It was the hip place to go, but there was this big disco versus rock and roll, and ultimately disco faded out and rock won. But you know what? The funny part is, 30 or 40 years ago, disco it never went away. It just changed names. It was dance music in the 80s. And then it became pop music with Britney Spears and Madonna still around and Katy Perry and Lady Gaga. That's all disco music, folks. So the sad part is, even though back in the 70s we thought that rock beat disco, but in the long game, disco won. Because that music is still around and those artists are still around. And there's certainly a sound even of the disco sound in a lot of the hip-hop music as well. So it's still here. But as I said, it's not surprising that the loop, a rock station, went away because the rock and roll audience is getting smaller. And I don't think the loop was playing any new music. They were probably playing mostly of the classics. Well, you know what? In today's world, I can listen to all that in my pocket. I don't need to listen to the radio. I could put my iPod in my car and listen to it. And so it's not surprising that that rock and roll radio, rock and roll as a genre has been shrinking in its impact. And so those former powerhouse radio stations that used to play such an influential role in spreading the word of rock and roll, it's not surprising that those would be going by the wayside. So for those of us here in the Chicago area, we remember the loop for many reasons, for its music, for its personalities, and for the role that it played in our lives. And so, yeah, there's a little nostalgic thing, but it's not surprising because, as I said, rock has, there was a song called Long Live Rock by The Who, and I still hope that, but we'll see what the expiration date might be. But Bob Seger had another one, and that was Rock and Roll Never Forgets. So I'll never forget it, but hopefully I won't have to completely forget it. But, who would have thought that 40 years ago we'd be saying goodbye to rock and roll? We might be saying that someday. And welcome back here to Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. And we go to the Pop Culture Club with Emily Arminetti. Hello, Emily.
Hello, Jim.
How you doing?
Well, I'm all right.
Yeah, how's Pepito? How's Pepito doing?
He's good.
Yeah, is he still there? You haven't lost him again?
He's still here.
Did you put...
Still under house arrest.
Oh, you still didn't put that on there, though.
No, you know what?
You didn't put the name tag on him. You did not put the collar with the name tag on. This has been 3 weeks already now.
I know, but I told you that I was going to do it after we talked about it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do it before we meet again.
And
then I got the flu and I was in bed and then I kind of forgot about it.
Oh, you know what? I was going to nominate you for Mom of the Year.
Oh no.
Forget about it. You're not even in the race.
Oh, come on. Moms get enough guilt as it is.
Well, 3 weeks ago, I can't find Pepito. Oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. Now it's like, moms don't get enough credit.
No, you and I fundamentally disagree on this. I believe that as long as Pepito is under house arrest, he's safe.
No, you've already proven that's not the case.
No, he used to be allowed out of the house. That was the problem.
I'd like to walk around that house and see where Pepito is right now. Could you put your hands on Pepito right now?
If I were so inclined to interrupt this recording, subject us to
all right, as long as you know where he is. All right, if you don't know what I'm talking about here, a few weeks ago Emily's daughter lost her prized little stuffed animal, and thanks to Elton Jim and his keen detective skills, within a day Emily could not find it for a week, and within a day my advice led to Pepito's,
triumphant return.
Within a day after she talked to me, she found it. On her own for a week, helpless. A lamb to the slaughter. She talks to Elton Jim. Next day, ho-ho! Pepito, back again. Thank you very much.
It was that night.
Sure, not even a day.
Later that night.
I wish I could impart these powers I have to you, but I can't. They're intrinsic. So we were talking about nominations for Mother of the Year, which you will not be, based on your Pepito, entire Pepito saga.
Yes, we've established that.
But speaking of nominees, the Oscars were a few weeks ago, and I don't want to get into, I mean, at this point, we've all known who the winners are, and to be honest with you, you know, it's funny. I'm watching the Oscars this year, and for the life of me, I could not remember who won Best Actor.
What do you mean? Like, who just won?
No, last year. Like, in 2017.
Oh, last year.
I could not remember that Casey Affleck.
I know who it is.
Yeah, Casey Affleck. But I could not remember, which really sent a message to me as I was watching this, the Oscars, because... I don't know about you. Before I get into my point here, let me just ask you. So Oscars 2018, that's the ceremony. The movies obviously were based on movies released in 2017. But as a telecast here, in their 90th anniversary of the Oscars, what did you think, not about the awards themselves, and not even so much about the winners, but I'm wondering about the show itself, about the presentation itself. As a four-hour extravaganza, what did you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of boring. It didn't help that there weren't really any surprises.
Wow, there were no surprises at all. This one, those winners went exactly the way 95% of the people, if not 99% of the people, predicted. I mean, there was really no surprise winner this year. Usually there's one wild one that gets like, whoa, where did that come from? Not this year at all. Wow.
Right. And, you know, I also like the fashion, and even the fashion was kind of dull this year.
Well, there was the whole Me Too thing, Time's Up. Everybody sort of got, you know, there wasn't a lot of plunging necklines or, you know, Angelina Jolie up high cut slits.
The leg.
Yeah. Although one of the actresses, I can't remember, one actress did do the Angelina pose. It was an African American actress. I can't remember her name, but she did the, she had the slit with the pose. I can't remember which one it was. But anyway, yeah. So here's my thing, you know, and you are a huge movie fan like me, which is one of the things that we've always bonded on as friends. And I have to say, I'm about midway through, you know, Jimmy Kimmel did a fine job. It was very serviceable, but there was nothing memorable in what he said. He basically, instead of last, you know, the year before, he brought those tourists in on a bus. You remember that?
Right, yeah.
So this year, he went across the street to a theater. So it was the same concept, just a, you know, a little tweak on it. Ever since.
I also was thinking to myself, like, if these people love movies, why are they at the movies? Why are they watching the Oscars? Why are they going? Because they were offered a free screening.
That is so true.
I don't remember what movie it was. I was like,
I never thought of that. That is so true. There shouldn't have been, to your point.
He's like, hey.
Yeah. To your point, then. So that means everybody on Sunday, every theater on Sunday should have been empty.
Well, yeah. I mean, those people don't even, he's like, well, we should reward the fans, but, you know. And it's like, I feel like those people are just fans of free stuff.
Right.
That's it. Not even movies.
That's too funny. So, yeah. So it's like, So he did a fine job. It was fine. It was okay. But there was nothing memorable about it. And then he, of course, ever since, you know, Ellen a few years ago went into the audience and took the selfie and did banter with people sitting. Now that's become a standard thing. And so he did that too, went down into the, so to me, it was just very serviceable. Nothing he said, you know, there were no jokes. He didn't want to offend anybody, so there was no edge to it. He told a couple of political jokes, but in that room, there's no edge to that because 99% of the people in the room all hated Trump. So those jokes felt very obligatory.
He's getting more political on his nightly talk.
Well, because he saw what it did for Stephen. Yeah, he saw what it did for Stephen Colbert. So, you know, I mean, that's why Colbert went from second or third to first in a commanding lead. So, but my point is that telling an anti-Trump joke in that audience was no risk because everybody in that room pretty much hates Trump. So that wasn't cutting edge at all. So there was nothing special about his hosting. He, you know, thankfully, I thought the coolest thing was, did you watch the whole show at the very end?
When he came out.
And yes. But did you see it at the very end, right before they gave away the Best Picture Oscar? They had a close-up of the envelope and the Oscar. And they said, after this message, that envelope's going to be open. So there was no question as to which envelope after last year's.
I think they were still using the same accountancy firm.
Yeah, it's just that,
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, they just didn't use,
They didn't trot them out on stage this year, did they?
No.
Missed that.
I didn't see that either.
So they're getting a little bit of a slap on the wrist there. It's like, okay, we're not giving you your moment in the spotlight anymore after what happened last year.
And I thought it was a cool, the one cool thing was actually that they brought Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway back to give the best picture one again this year after last year's screw up. So I thought that was kind of cool. But so my question to you is, being a movie fan, and you know the cliche now is, the Oscars are like the Super Bowl for movies. But I'm just wondering. I watched this thing. It was a 4-hour show, like you said. It was really boring. And I'm just wondering. I look at the Grammys, which always used to be kind of the elitist music award show. And it used to be filled with all these technical awards and the same thing. And it never got good ratings. And about 5-10 years ago, they decided, you know what? This is not an award show. This is a TV show. And we have to play to the audience. And so they took away a lot of the categories. They didn't televise every technical thing. Now the Grammys pick about 6 or 7 key very popular awards and the rest, and they give those away. But the rest of the show is all about performance and music and celebrating the music. And I'm wondering, and maybe the Oscars, it felt so old and so out of touch this year that I think they need to blow this up, and they need to say, you know what, we need the Oscars need to be a TV show, not an award show. So like we did, we talked early when the nominations came out, if you remember, you know, the main awards, the four, you know, the best supporting actor, the best actor, best picture, best director, maybe, you know, screenplay, maybe the songs this year were horrible. My God, that was embarrassing half the time. And maybe they just pick those six. I understand sound editing and...
Well, see, that's the tough thing, though. It's like they already do like a separate, more technical award ceremony. But then you start to think, I mean, because then it does get... So I'm of two minds on this. Because, yes, actually, when you think about it, it's mostly those, like, technical type awards that they still put in the broadcast that actually take up the bulk of the ceremony.
Right.
And when it's 4 hours long, that's a lot, you know. That said, you know, I think it is nice to recognize the people behind the camera who don't always get all the glory. They're not constantly...
Yeah, but that sounds good, but you don't listen to that. For that two seconds, do you listen? Do you care?
I do. The only reason I listen, though, is because every once in a while, one of those people ends up having the best speech of the night. You know, like a few years ago, when the guy who won for, like, best animated short was like, thank you, my pencil. I think he was like, you know, he was Japanese, and English is a second language. And I just thought it was the sweetest moment of the entire night.
I know, but I
he
just...
was like, thank you, my wife. Thank you, my pencil. And that was beautiful.
I get that, but
I hate to miss out on those moments too. Where
those are so few and far between.
I mean,
I remember. They always start the show right off the bat by giving out one of the major categories. Now, what I found interesting, usually the first Oscar for the last several years, many years, has always been Best Supporting Actress. What I thought was interesting is that they gave away Best Supporting Actor first, because it was almost like we're going to say, you know, once again, we're in a female empowerment kind of world here.
Right.
So we're going to save the actress stuff for deeper in the show, because that's where there's more interest now, you know?
Well, and the show does actually, I mean, it kicks off with the supporting categories because they've got to get people hooked from the beginning, but then you've got this long...
Well, that's my point.
You know, like the technical words, but then it does build, and then you have Best actress and actor, and then it culminates in Best Film.
I know, but here's my point.
The way they present it is almost as if you get a little bit of something interesting, and then you wait until, and then at the end, it's the really important awards. And so you don't also want to make it seem like, oh, supporting actress, well, that's the least important of the acting categories, so we'll make that one first. So maybe that's why they decided to change it up.
Yeah.
Sort of be like, well, you know.
But my point is, so they gave away that first one, and I'm like, okay, this is cool. Now I had my adrenaline is pumping, and then, just as you said, we had to wait an hour, if not more, for another significant, award to be given out. And it's like, no, I think they need, you know, I think the Grammys are 3 hours. My suggestion would be just do the 6 or 7 major categories of acting, maybe throw in best songs. You can have some singing. That's fine. You know, and then screenplays and stuff like that, along with the six that we talked about. Pick those. I'm sorry if you can tell me, Emily, if you can tell me the difference between sound editing and sound mixing, then I'll give you an Oscar.
Right.
Because I don't know what the hell's the difference, and yet there's 20 minutes right there. So.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
it's tough to say, though. I don't know if it's just the length. I mean, I feel like they need to do something. I mean, I read that this year was the least viewed television.
Yeah, it went there. Yeah, I mean, it went down. The ratings were down 16% from last year, and last year was the lowest rated, or one of the lowest rated.
But here's a really weird thing. Okay, that said, well, I mean, first of all, we have to qualify this by saying there are still 26 million people watching it even this year. You know, so that's a lot. I mean, it's still, you know, and even like the Super Bowl, I read, was down.
Right.
Ratings. Yeah. It was like a 7-year low. So, you know, in general, things are happening. Obviously, there are other distractions. Like, everybody's streaming now. Nobody watches stuff in real time.
Right.
You're streaming. So, you know, that tide has turned. But, you know, this is what I thought was really weird. When I was reading about the ratings, they had a list of, like, I don't know, the last, like, you know, 20 years. And in 1998... the ratings were more than double what they were this year. Okay? And I'm looking at that going, well, what was happening in 1998 that made it so spectacular?
Right.
You know, now, obviously it was a different host. I mean, Billy Crystal used to host a lot back then. And maybe it's better to bring out people that aren't on TV every night. Maybe that's more interesting to the audience. But the other thing is, like, I looked it up because I was like, what was going on that year? So Titanic was the big movie that year. That was a huge movie. It's probably one of the highest grossing movies in the history of film. And if you think about it, like, this year, not many of the films that were nominated were, like, massive blockbusters.
Well, exactly. You know? And that was one of my points, too, is that that's why I think the Oscars are obsolete or becoming obsolete, because what's happened, and you're exactly correct, not only are there a lot of options that we have now with the internet and streaming and, you know, pay-per-view, and I could watch any movie whatever I want, but to your point, they expanded the amount of movies that can be nominated for Best Picture from 5 to 10.
Right.
But here's the thing. Even the 9 this year, it can fluctuate. Sometimes there's 7, sometimes there's 8. This year there were 9 movies nominated. Out of those 9, only 2 made more than $100 million. So clearly there's a huge disconnect between, and because don't forget, the movie industry is doing fairly well. They're making billions of dollars. But the thing is that the movies that people are going to are all aimed now at a very small demographic, from 12-year-old to, say, 25. They're all superhero CGI kind of movies. That's the major Hollywood movie now. And those movies are not recognized on the Oscars. So you make an excellent point here. That when there's a, what happened was, we're in a different age now. Don't forget, that's 20 years ago. We are fully in an area of different platforms, different choices, and the movies now are made for such a small group. And yet, what's happening is the 12 or 13 year olds or 20 year olds are not going to watch the Oscars because they say, just as you just said, hey, none of my movies are nominated, so who cares? On the other side of the coin is people older say, this movie, Shape of Water, something like that. They don't know anything about the Justice League or Wonder Woman because they're not going to see those. So there's a huge kind of disconnect between the movie industry, which is making money, and it was making money at a certain kind of age group, and then the Oscars, who are kind of elitist, who are trying to award art, well, nobody is seeing those movies. So
right.
So,
well, and here's another interesting thing that makes me think that this has something to do with it. So the all-time high was 1998, like I said, but then dropped by 10 million viewers from 98 to 99, which was a huge drop if you look at the list from 20 years. So then, what happened there? Well, the film that won Best Picture in 1999 was Shakespeare in Love. Certainly some a lot of people saw, but I don't think many people actually started going to the theater to see that until it was getting a lot of awards buzz. And I'm not sure that, I mean, and obviously it was nothing like Titanic. I mean, Titanic was a huge phenomenon.
So maybe it
does have to do with how invested
But here's my point. So
whether this film that they really liked is going
to
win.
So here's what I think they need to do. They need to bridge that gap somehow, so that the people that are spending money and going out to the movies have some kind of a vested interest in the Academy Awards, and vice versa, the people that see these other movies find out what's going on in the other movie world, which they are not tapping into, in terms of the 58th Thor movie or the 28th Iron Man movie. that once again, I talked earlier in the show about a communal experience. We have less communal experiences because of all the platforms that are available to watch whatever we want, whenever we want. And so I think that's where the disconnect is. Don't forget, in 98, to your point, the internet was around, but it wasn't as, dominant as it is today. And there was no iPhone at that, because the iPhone has changed everything. So you can't discount the impact of technology. But here's what I think should do. Like the Grammys did with movies, the Oscars needs to celebrate movies, not celebrate the awards. So let's have a show that has the main awards. And how do we fill the gap then? Because and you could give away those six awards in 15 minutes. What do the Grammys do? They feature the acts of the day, as well as they do all these pairings of like legends with newer people. And so those performances become the calling card, not the awards themselves, but wow, look who's going to be like this year. You know, Elton played with Miley Cyrus and U2 played with with this and stuff like that, as well as the main people of the day and, Kendrick Lamar and things like that opened the show. What movies need to do is show clips. They did that a little this year. There was like these little bumpers, but show extended pieces of here's the extended pieces of the movies, or here's a collection of great movies of the past and great movies of the present, and celebrate the movies and create movie fans and try to create some kind of communal experience for the audience and give away a few awards. But it's not an award show anymore. It started out as an award show, as a luncheon 90 years ago, and it was a purely industry kind of thing. It's not an industry thing anymore. To your point, 25 million people watched it around the world, God knows how many. It's a TV show. It's entertainment. So sell your movies, sell your art form, but don't just bog it down with all these awards that no one knows who the winners are. Nobody even knows what the categories are.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing about the Grammys, though, is like with the performances, it's just that lends itself more to having actual performances because they're.
But I would love to see.
I think it's harder for when you're talking about film. I mean, I guess it.
But I would love to see a 10-minute clip or like a 7-minute clip of In the Shape of Water. I didn't see the movie, but I'd love to see, rather than just 2 seconds or a little montage, show me a scene. Show me like a nice 5-minute scene. If you had more time to do that, if you had to give away these awards, we could really get a sense of to say, geez, I wish I would have seen it at the theater. Maybe I'll start going to movies again. I don't go to the movie theater anymore because, like I said, I'm not into superhero movies. And and if I wanted to go see a movie about Winston Churchill, it's out in one theater for 2 weeks and then it's gone.
Yeah. Well, I think there is, I agree with you that they do need to do something different, and it is always weird to me that this is an award show where they basically don't let people have any time to give speeches.
I know.
but they need to save time for like Jimmy Kimmel to go
exactly
grab a bunch of nominees and take them across the street to the theater to do a sketch, or you hear all this kind of lame banter, and so they spend more time on that kind of stuff. They don't want to let anyone talk once they've gotten an award, and they only show like very, very short one sentence clips when they're introducing.
That's my point.
So I do think you're right. They do have it a bit upside down, but it's a question of finding a balance of what do people actually want to see.
I think they need to blow this up and start over. They need to do what the Cubs did. They need to blow up the team. They need to blow up the Oscars. Start from scratch. I think you make a very good point about the host. I would say next year there's no doubt there's going to be a woman hosting it. But
don't get me wrong. I love Jimmy Kimmel. I do.
Really? I'm not a big fan of his.
No,
but
right. I mean, and not everybody is. But, even I, like, if I can see him do stand-up every night.
Right.
At least during the week, anyway.
The Oscars used to be hosted
every single night.
The Oscars used to be hosted by some of the biggest stars in the world, not you know, once again, the reason why Jimmy Kimmel's hosting is because it's on ABC and he's their late night host. There's no question about that. Jimmy Kimmel is not hosting that show if he doesn't have a show on ABC. They used to have Johnny Carson, who was on NBC, but he would host the Oscars on ABC because he was the one of the bigger stars. Bob Hope used to be a regular host. There used to be Gregory Peck. There used to be major stars, to your point, who you don't see all the time hosting it because it was a big event. And now it's become so commercialized, so tied in, so cross-promotioned. And this year, it was so boring, the whole thing. I just sat there and said, wow, I used to love watching this. As I've said many times, I used to be so into the Oscars. I used to, I think I even told you this, I used to like type up my winners, put them in an envelope of the main categories, give them to my wife, and then she would open my envelope at the same time they were announcing to see if I won or not. I haven't done my envelope thing in 10 years.
I remember you used to do that.
I don't do my envelopes anymore because it's like, who cares?
But see, I will still watch because it will always be my Super Bowl.
Well, it's because right now, I guarantee you, if you asked more people were more interested in the red carpet show than the award show itself. I guarantee you, if you went on the street and asked people, what were you more interested, the fashion and the red carpet show or the actual awards? More people could tell me what Jennifer Lawrence wore than who won Best Sound Editing. No question about that.
Well, of course, of course.
So,
well, and, you know, this year's red carpet was not, it was really kind of lame anyway because, like, nobody talked to Ryan Seacrest.
Yeah, right.
He's in trouble.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like, after the red carpet was over and the ceremony was starting, I thought to myself, did any of the nominees stopped to talk to him? I think like one or two.
I think Christopher Plummer did, I think, for like 45 minutes. That's all he could get.
Well, Christopher Plummer is like 89 years old. He probably has no clue what's going on with Ryan.
I know.
You know? I mean, he's like, I don't know. He had to shoot that movie in like his part in that movie in like 8 days.
I know.
He probably doesn't know which way is up.
Yeah. Well, we will see if they take our advice next year. But my suggestion would be that there needs to be some major rethinking if the Oscars going to continue to be your Super Bowl. It's your Super Bowl. Right now, it's not even my Rose Bowl. So we'll see. As I leave you, I just say, please, please put a name tag on Pepito. Please. And we will we'll talk to you next week. Take care.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye. And that ends another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic right here at WGNplus.com, episode 95. Every Monday, a new episode is posted. Hope you will go there weekly and often to listen to whatever this is. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. I had a good time. I hope you did, too. This has been Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, the only podcast from the end of the web to your screen.